We only got through 17, right? Is that right? Okay, so 18 is a list of all the biological amino acids. The 20 that organisms use. Remember, there's no limit to amino acids, but these 20 biological amino acids are grouped into these major groups based on the chemical properties of the R groups, which are the only variable part from amino acid to amino acid. So notice each R group is the part in white, but notice that everything else is exactly the same in every amino acid. That's what it means to be an amino acid: a carboxyl, a hydrogen, an amino, all connected to a carbon, and then something else. That R group is what makes them different. Well, some of those are mostly hydrocarbons, or at least, hydrocarbons are nonpolar. They're not all nonpolar. I mean, they're not all hydrocarbons here, but they all have basically the same electronegativities, so they're all nonpolar R groups. Then there are some amino acids with polar R groups, and that's, of course, going to affect how they interact with other things. Polar is kind of like partially charged, right? Well, and then you have some R groups that are actually ionized, and they therefore have full charges, either positive or negative. Okay, now to 19, let's talk about building a polypeptide. A polypeptide is a polymer. Specifically, it's a polymer made by hooking together amino acids, which are the monomers. And unlike polysaccharides, which can be branched, polypeptides cannot be branched. Why is it that polysaccharides can be branched? Remember? If you think about the monomers, which are the ringed form of monosaccharides for a polysaccharide, right? There are multiple OH points, right? Each of those is a potential connection point for a glycosidic linkage. So a single monomer can have multiple connections to other monomers, which is what a branch point is. That's not true, though, when you build a polypeptide out of amino acids, because hooking together amino acids can be done only one way. You see the linking right here. Two have already been linked. You're going to add one more. The specific name for the covalent bond between adjacent, next to, in other words, amino acids is peptide bond. So we called them glycosidic linkages for the bonds between monosaccharides and a polysaccharide. The bond between amino acids in a polypeptide are called peptide bonds. That's why the overall thing is called a polypeptide, because when you have many amino acids, you have many peptide bonds. But a single peptide bond between two adjacent amino acids is another example of building big things out of small, right? Which you should already know involves a dehydration reaction. So something is going to lose an OH, something is going to lose an H. Those come out as water. See that happening right here. And that allows you then to sew the two together to form the bigger thing. That's the formation of the peptide bond. But it can only be done by hooking the amino group of one amino acid to the carboxyl group of the other amino acid. And that's why there is no branching in a polypeptide. You can think of it initially as just a linear arrangement, no branching, of some number of amino acids. But any amino acid can be used in any position. So you have 20 choices if you're an organism, because there's 20 biological amino acids. It's like making a necklace out of beads. And you can make it any size, any length. Plus, you have 20 kits of beads to work with. You can use any one of them in each position. So imagine how many possibilities there are. Effectively, no limit. That's why there are so many jobs that proteins do, because They can have so many shapes based on so many possible sequences of amino acids. All right, so this is peptide bond formation, which is dehydration reaction, but the specific bond is called a peptide bond. Oh, the important other point about this, though, is that notice the peptide bonds are the only things holding the polypeptide together as a strand. And the peptide bonds do not at all involve the R groups, right? So the R groups, the variable part of each amino acid, is simply hanging off of the chain. They're not held together. They don't hold the chain together. Instead, just the amino and carboxyl groups of the amino acids hold them together. Okay. Now let's go to 20 and look at a couple different representations of a protein. This happens to be lysozyme, an example of an enzyme, but it doesn't actually matter what the specific protein is. The point is we can visualize them different ways. A space-filling model is nice that we can do that with computers nowadays, but it doesn't really give you much, I don't think. I like the ribbon model because it reminds you, using a ribbon to represent a polypeptide, reminds you of the fact, as I just said, that a polypeptide is a continuous string of amino acids with no branching, just like a ribbon. So it has two ends and no branches in between. These yellow things, by the way, are disulfide bridges, which we'll discuss in a different slide. But anyway, that's one polypeptide that you see there, one ribbon. 21, also representations of proteins. Actually, there's two different proteins here. One from a human making up this antibody, which are immune proteins that help you identify foreign material that might be harmful to you. It's the basis of vaccines, right? A vaccine stimulates your body into making specific antibodies that will recognize just the right thing that you're trying to prevent being infected with, like a flu virus in this case. Also a protein, by the way. But this reinforces what I've said multiple times already, namely that shape is everything when it comes to protein function. Whatever the function is, which can be from a diverse list of functions, as we've mentioned, the protein has its specific function because of its specific shape. Here you can see that because an antibody has to work by having just the right shape to recognize a specific antigen, which is the foreign material that is shaped complementary to that antibody, like a lock and a key. Okay, now speaking of shape, let's go to 22 and talk about four levels of protein shape. Or protein structure, I should say, more correctly. Before I go through these, explain something that I said in an earlier lecture, which is that up to now I've kind of loosely been using the words polypeptide and protein more or less interchangeably. That's not always the case. They sometimes are interchangeable words, they're sometimes not. It depends on the context. So let me explain what I mean by that. Some proteins are made up of just one polypeptide. So it's just one ribbon, one strand of amino acids, however long, with two ends. And that's all there is to that protein for some proteins. In that case, for just those proteins, then the word polypeptide and the word protein really are referring to the same thing, right, in that particular case. There are, though, more complex proteins, and we call those as a group. Oh, I didn't erase my board, so it's already up there. Multimeric proteins, which is another word meaning multiple parts, right? Polymer and multimer really mean the same thing, but we use a different word here because we're at different levels of structure, basically. A multimeric protein is a protein that's made of two or more polypeptides. Now keep in mind that each polypeptide individually is already a polymer, right? Made out of multiple amino acid subunits. So you hook a bunch of those together, you have one polypeptide. In some proteins, you're done. That's the whole protein. But in other proteins, you may have multiple polypeptides that are arranged together to form the more complex protein that we call a multimeric protein. And importantly, you don't do that by linking together the polypeptides that make it up end to end. If you did that, you would just be making one bigger polypeptide, right? So in a multimeric protein, however many polypeptides make it up, they remain individual polypeptides. Each one is a ribbon by itself with two ends. But they're held together by other forces making up the overall protein. Okay, and in that case, then the word polypeptide and protein are not interchangeable. In the case of a multimeric protein, the word polypeptide refers to just part of the overall protein. It just refers to one polypeptide within that protein. Okay, now let's go to these four levels of structure, which you can see are called primary, secondary, tertiary, and quaternary. Those are words that just mean first, second, third, and fourth levels, basically. Every single protein has or features at least the first three of these levels. Every protein has a primary, a secondary, and a tertiary structure. Multimeric proteins, the ones that are made out of multiple polypeptides, have all three of those levels, plus they have quaternary structure. But only the multimeric proteins have quaternary structure. All right, now let's go through these one by one. Primary structure is simply the specific amino acid sequence making up one polypeptide. Yeah?
Sorry, you said only what has that?
Only multimeric proteins, the ones that are made out of multiple polypeptides. Okay, let me repeat that primary structure. It's the specific amino acid sequence making up one polypeptide. And that's represented here, the polypeptide is represented by a string of beads, which is a good analogy because a string of beads also doesn't branch, or a normal string of beads doesn't branch, right? It's just some sequence of beads. Well, each bead is an amino acid. And the three-letter abbreviations here are just abbreviations for the specific amino acids. It doesn't matter, but they're glycine, proline, threonine, and so on. Those are the 20 biological amino acids that are used. Okay. So the primary structure refers to how many amino acids are used, because you can make a necklace any length. And also, which amino acid of the 20 is used in each position. Now, primary structure actually then determines all of the higher levels of structure. Because depending on what that sequence is, a polypeptide will have one kind of structure or another. The secondary structure of a protein refers to whether or not that protein features either of these often repeating structural motifs, which are called beta pleated sheets, kind of like accordion folds, or alpha helices. An alpha helix is, like any helix, a corkscrew shape. Not all proteins have these, but many do, and any given protein can have either or both or multiples of each. Whatever that case is with respect to these two major repeating motifs, that's the secondary structure. So it's not the entire overall three-dimensional shape of it. It's basically just what's going on with respect to these two sub-features. okay, or subshapes. The tertiary structure is the overall three-dimensional shape of a single polypeptide. You can see it represented here as a ribbon. Important that it's a single polypeptide that we're talking about for tertiary structure. And so that goes back to what I said earlier. If it's a protein that's made up of just one polypeptide, then the tertiary structure is as far as we get. That's the overall shape of the polypeptide, which is the protein. Okay? But if it's a multimeric protein, then there are at least two, maybe more, polypeptides grouped together. Each individual constituent polypeptide in a multimeric protein has its own tertiary structure. But the way in which the constituent polypeptides are grouped together gives the overall complex multimeric protein its overall shape, which is the quaternary structure. All right, is that all clear? You see the difference between all of them? Okay. Let's then go to 23 and talk about some ways in which connections can be made between amino acids to stabilize the shape. So once again, we're using a ribbon model here to represent the backbone, which is made by all the aminos and carboxyls joined together. That's what holds it together along the length. But keep in mind that all the R groups are just hanging off of that, right? But those R groups can be polar, nonpolar, or charged. You have adjacent amino acids forming polypeptides. Adjacent means they're right next to each other in the sequence. Non-adjacent ones, though, have R groups that might interact with each other if the overall ribbon or polypeptide is bent in such a way that those non-adjacent amino acids come close together. And there's four major possibilities here on how they can form interactions. One is hydrogen bonding, just like between water molecules and for exactly the same reason. But here you have an amino acid in this position with an R group that's nonpolar, and at one way up here, not next to it, but brought close to it by bending, it's also polar, and therefore it can form hydrogen bonding between them. Not very strong, just like it's not very strong between water molecules, but it's stronger than nothing. And so it stabilizes the shape, but it also makes that shape happen to begin with. So that this is what I meant when I said primary structure determines the other levels. Because of that specific sequence, and because of the chemical properties of those R groups in that sequence, when that polypeptide gets finished being made, it's going to naturally fold into a specific shape because that's the way the R groups want to interact. All right, that's one possibility, hydrogen bonding. You also have what are called hydrophobic interactions. And notice this is involving R groups that are hydrocarbon R groups, which are nonpolar, right? Hydrocarbons are nonpolar because carbon and hydrogen have about the same electronegativity. So you might expect them not to have any attraction for each other. And they almost don't, except that if the electrons are moving just right, there can be. That's what I was trying to explain to my other section when I wrote this CH, just part of a methyl on one and a CH on the other. Now, in this, each of these is a nonpolar bond, right? So the electrons are equally shared between the C and the H. But at any given moment, the electrons have to be somewhere, right? They're either closer to the C or closer to the H. And so they're going back and forth between C and H. Well, if this other one is going back and forth between C and H, but they're doing it in unison like this, so that the electrons are with the H on one and with the C on the other, and then back, that's going to give them slight attraction to each other. Does that make sense? Even though they're nonpolar. That's called a hydrophobic interaction. This is why geckos are able to walk on a glass ceiling without falling off of it. It's hydrophobic interactions between their foot pads and the glass. Okay, next in yellow is the disulfide bridge, which you saw three examples of in that previous slide when I mentioned it. This happens when you have a cysteine amino acid in one position and another cysteine in another position that get bent, that get close to each other because of the bending of the backbone. If you go back to the table of all the biological amino acids, you'll see that cysteine has, as part of its R group, a sulfhydryl. And remember from the functional group discussions that a sulfhydryl is an SH, right, instead of an OH. So each of these was an SH originally, before the bond occurred. But if they get close to the two sulfhydryls get close to each other, each sulfhydryl will lose its own hydrogen. And that allows the two sulfurs to be bonded together covalently. And of course, a covalent bond between sulfurs, this disulfide bridge, is much stronger than hydrophobic interactions or hydrogen bonding. So this really will stabilize the shape of a protein. And I think that's why I said earlier that if you burn hair, you smell sulfur. Hair has a bunch of disulfide bridges in it to make it really strong. You can also form ionic bonds. If you have two R groups that are ionic, but one's positive and one's negative, they're going to have an electrostatic attraction for each other, just like an anion and a cation are do in a salt. Right, for exactly the same reason, opposite charges. All of these together, though, determine not only the shape to begin with, but then keep the shape pretty stabilized unless there's a change in the environment, because the environment affects the chemistry of all of this. More about that in a minute. But first, let's go to 24. It's more about shape, really. Overall, any given protein, of course, has a shape. But for any given individual protein, you can lump it into one of two major shape groups. It's either fibrous, like the collagen example here, which is a protein that is long in one direction. It forms strands, in other words, like a fiber. Or it is a globular protein, which isn't long in any one direction. It's just a glob. And there's plenty of examples of each of them, but hemoglobin's an example of a globular protein, compact, whereas collagen's an example of a fibrous protein. Fibrous proteins tend to function as structural elements, like ropes or cables. They're strong. Hair, skin, and nails have collagen in them for that reason. Globular proteins have a wide array of functions, like enzymes, for instance, are globular proteins. Hemoglobin is a transport protein whose function is to carry oxygen and carbon dioxide, but it's globular in shape. That's the real importance of the slide, but also notice that both of these examples happen to be multimeric proteins. Each one is made of multiple constituent polypeptides. It also illustrates the fact that to be multimeric, you don't have to be made of different types of polypeptides. Collagen's made of three, but they're identical to each other. It's three copies of the same polypeptide. Hemoglobin's made of four overall, two copies of one type and two of another. Okay, 25. Speaking of hemoglobin, its normal job is to efficiently carry oxygen from the lungs to the cells of the body and then carry carbon dioxide from the cells of the body to the lungs. It does it really well if it has the right shape. But the shape, as I've said, depends on the primary structure, which is the specific sequence of amino acids. On the left, you have normal hemoglobin. And, well, there's two subunits, but the beta subunit is the one we're concerned with right here. It has more than seven amino acids in it. It's much bigger than that. But the first seven are shown here in abbreviated form, valine, histidine, and so on. If it has the right sequence, not only through these seven, but for all of them that it's made out of, then it will have the right shape. Is that you're raising your hand?
No, I'm just there.
Okay. And it'll complex along with another beta and two identical alphas to form the overall hemoglobin molecule. There are millions of hemoglobin molecules in just one red blood cell. And then there are billions of red blood cells in your bloodstream. So you have billions of millions of hemoglobin molecules copied in your body, doing a good job of carrying these gases. On the right-hand side, though, we have hemoglobin in a person afflicted with sickle cell disease. And it shows you the importance of primary structure. Here, the sequence is almost right. Every amino acid, even the ones beyond seven, is correct, except number six, where it was supposed to be glutamic acid, it's valine instead. And that one amino acid difference means it's going to fold up into three dimensions into a different shape, and therefore not function the same way. In the case of the misshapen one, not only does it cause the hemoglobin to not do as good a job of carrying oxygen and carbon dioxide, which is bad for you, but it also causes what should be individual hemoglobins to clump together, which is also bad for you. So sickle cell disease is a serious condition. You can see that it's called sickle cell disease because the cells, instead of being a normal biconcave disc, they're sickle-shaped. But why would a cell make this defective version of hemoglobin? Why would it put a valine there instead of a glutamic acid? Well, the cell doesn't know how to build any protein, right? You can't make just any possible protein, of which there's no limit to. You're stuck with the number of proteins you can make because a cell has to have instructions for how to build a protein. And the original indirect source of that instruction is your genes, your DNA. So if the DNA gets changed, which we call mutation, the cell doesn't realize it's an error. It just obeys the DNA instructions and puts valine there instead of glutamic acid, and that's what causes the disease. So it's an indication of what I've said already a couple times. DNA does not directly give you your traits. DNA determines what proteins you're able to build, and your proteins directly give you your traits, like here, sickle cell disease symptoms. Okay, 26. This one also has to do with protein shape. The shape of any given protein is also called its conformation. That's just another word for shape when it comes to proteins. But the conformation has to be right. The shape has to be right for the function to be right. And if the environmental conditions change, things like temperature and pH, which we've talked about, then that causes the interaction between the R groups to be different and therefore the shape to be different. And usually that means it's not going to function properly or as well. So that change in conformation that can occur is called denaturation. The protein is denatured if it loses its shape. Now, if it's not too drastic a denaturation, which is caused maybe by a temperature or a pH change, for instance, if it's not too drastic and you restore the conditions, either to normal temp or normal pH, then it's possible in certain circumstances for it to renature, to go back to its shape that will make it work well. But if it's too drastic a denaturation, then that's permanent. And that protein is worthless as an overall protein because it's never going to work. It's still valuable as a source of raw materials for building other proteins, because you can break it down into amino acids and reuse them. But you saw a good indication of this last week in the lab when you did the egg white thing with the strong acid in one treatment and the heat in the other treatment. They really led to pretty much the same looking stuff, right? Which is the look of cooked egg albumin. It becomes white. Texture totally changed, right? Same thing with just about anything you cook. The texture change, you cook meat, it's definitely different from raw meat. That's denaturation of proteins that's causing that, because you've changed the temperature drastically. And that's an instance of a permanent change, right? You can't decide after cooking an egg that you don't really want that egg. You just leave it out in room temperature. It's not going to turn back into liquid albumin. It's a permanent change. So denaturation is bad in most cases because it basically eliminates that protein from functioning, and that's why acid rain was such a big deal that I talked about earlier. 27 is still more information about shape. Some proteins, or I should say polypeptides more specifically, some polypeptides aren't able to attain their proper shape for doing whatever they do out in the open in the cell, in the major compartment, the cytoplasm. Conditions aren't right for it to fold up properly in some cases. So some polypeptides need the help of still other proteins to have their proper shape come about. And those helper proteins are called chaperone proteins, or chaperonins, that are really shaped like little canisters with a hollow interior. The not yet properly folded polypeptide gets put into there, and that gives it the right conditions separated from the rest of the cell so that it can take on its correct shape, and then it's released. Once it's in the right shape, it's pretty stabilized, so it doesn't need any help anymore. Okay, now we get to 28 here, and this is kind of a transition slide, because this serves at the same time as the ending slide for the protein section that we just are ending, and also as the first slide in the nucleic acid section, which is the only remaining macromolecule we haven't treated in this chapter yet. And it goes hand in hand with what I was saying earlier about DNA determining what proteins you can make indirectly. It's an indirect process because DNA is not directly involved in building the proteins. DNA, though, is a nucleic acid. RNA is another kind of nucleic acid. That's what the NA part of DNA and RNA means, nucleic acid. And why do they get that name? Because in a eukaryotic cell, that's where you find the DNA, in the nucleus. Nucleic means of the nucleus. But don't let that confuse you, because prokaryotic cells, of course, by definition, don't have a nucleus, but they certainly have DNA. They were the first cells to have DNA. They were the first cells. They need DNA for the same reason that any cell does, just that they aren't. That DNA isn't in its own compartment. But anyway, nucleic acids come in two major varieties, DNA and RNA. And both of these are involved in constructing a protein. But the DNA is the original source of the information. A gene, which is made out of DNA, is a lot like an instruction manual that is at a library, but it's a non-circulating book. You're not allowed to check it out. But you want to build the thing at home, you have to build it at home, you can't build it in the library. So you can't remember everything, and therefore you need to make a transcript. You need to write down the information from the manual so you can take that transcript with you and then use it to directly build the thing. That's what's happening here in a step that's called transcription. That's the part that DNA is directly involved in. So the information that's in a gene is used to build another nucleic acid, but an RNA, specifically a messenger RNA or an mRNA, that now holds the information to how to build the protein. DNA's job at this point is done. But now that you have the mRNA, it can go out into the main cytoplasm, exit the nucleus, and meet up with a ribosome, which is another organelle whose job it is to actually assemble the polypeptide one amino acid at a time. The messenger RNA tells the ribosome how many amino acids to use and which one to use in each position. And peptide bonds are made one by one until you have the whole string of beads like you have in this purple example. Okay, so that's the link between your genes and the proteins that actually directly give you your traits. Yeah, go ahead. Ribosomes are little molecular machines that assemble polypeptides one amino acid at a time. And I'm glad you asked that because that step is called translation. Transcription comes first. That DNA is involved in that. DNA is not involved in translation. RNA is. All right, but both have to happen in order to actually have the polypeptide. A cell doesn't know how to build one out of scratch. It has to have instructions. All right, now the same thing's happening in a prokaryotic cell, except that there is no nucleus. 29 now. Okay, let's take a closer look at a nucleic acid. And they're called nucleic acids even in prokaryotes that don't have nuclei. But as I already said, a nucleic acid is either a DNA or an RNA. Now, when we talk about a single DNA, we're really talking about two molecules complex together. Kind of like a multimeric protein is made by complexing together polypeptides, right? Each polypeptide in a hemoglobin is really a molecule by itself, a polymer already, right? Similarly, what we call a single DNA, or one DNA, is really two strands, each of which is its own polymer made out of monomers hooked together. So it's two separate molecules, really, but they're complex together to form one DNA. DNA is a double-stranded nucleic acid. RNA, on the other hand, is usually a single strand, so it's one polymer, which could be represented by one ribbon. Whatever the case, whether it's a DNA or an RNA, it is a polymer, and therefore it's made by hooking together subunits. The subunits are different from the other polymers we've already talked about, right? Polysaccharides are polymers made out of monomers called monosaccharides. Polypeptides are polymers made out of monomers called amino acids. Well, nucleic acids are polymers made out of monomers called nucleotides, which is why another name for a long strand of nucleotides is polynucleotide, meaning many nucleotides long. This example on the left edge is a tiny example. There's only four nucleotides hooked together here. In a typical DNA molecule, which is what makes up a chromosome, there are millions of nucleotides hooked together in just one DNA. So this is just a tiny sample here. But it shows you that it's one nucleotide after another. Yeah, go ahead. Nucleotides long. Yeah. So it's like millions of beads strung together for a DNA, not just four like here. Okay, now compare this to the structure of a polypeptide. Polypeptides, unlike polysaccharides, do not branch, right? Because there's only one way you can make peptide bonds to hook the carboxyl to the amino of the next one. No branching. Similarly here, The only way you can hook one nucleotide to the next is by hooking the phosphate of one nucleotide to the sugar of the next nucleotide. Okay? And that repeats over and over for however many nucleotides you have. Phosphate, sugar, phosphate, all the way down the line. That's the only thing that holds this thing together as a polynucleotide, the sugars and the phosphates. And that's why it's called the sugar phosphate backbone. Similarly, in a polypeptide, it's only the aminos and the carboxyls bonded together in peptide bonds that hold the thing together, right? Remember that in a polypeptide, the R groups are not at all involved in holding it together. They're just hanging off the edge, or hanging off the chain, right? Same thing here. Only the sugar and phosphate are involved. This other piece is just hanging off. So let's talk about that other piece and plus the sugar and the phosphate. What we have in detail in the middle is a single nucleotide, just one monomer of many making up a polynucleotide. But even though this is a single subunit, one monomer, it has three components to it. To be a nucleotide, you have to have a pentose sugar. And remember that pentose is not a specific chemical. It's a category of sugars. Pent means five, so it's a five-carbon sugar. Well, there's many different five-carbon sugars, but there are two that are used to make nucleic acids in organisms. And those are shown in the lower right here. The one with the red name underneath is ribose. The other one is almost identical, notice. Every atom is exactly the same, except for this one that is at the number 2 carbon position. In ribose, that's an OH connected to that number 2 carbon. In the other, it's just hydrogen instead of OH, so there's no oxygen there. And that's why this other pentose is called deoxyribose. It's like ribose without that extra oxygen, or with one oxygen removed, deoxy. Okay, so deoxyribose is the pentose sugar that's used in every nucleotide of the whole DNA, which is why it's called deoxyribonucleic acid. So when I said it was millions of nucleotides long, every single nucleotide will have deoxyribose as that sugar. In other words, the sugar within a nucleic acid, the sugar is not a source of variability between nucleotides. It's not a reason for there to be different nucleotides. And similarly, in any RNA, every single nucleotide in that overall RNA will be ribose. So it's no source of variation. Hooked to that pentose are the other two components of the three making up the nucleotide, and they're hooked at opposite ends. At one end is a phosphate group. So this is another bit of importance about the phosphate group. Can't have any nucleic acids, no DNA or RNA without phosphate. So it's no life without phosphate. But all phosphate groups are the same as each other. So it's also not a source of variability between nucleotides. Okay? The third component, though, which is connected to the other side of that sugar, is some sort of nitrogenous base. Nitrogenous just means that it contains nitrogen. And there are many different nitrogenous bases possible, but in normal nucleotides that make up nucleic acids, it's one of four. There's five possible shown here. But DNA uses four of those five, and RNA uses four of those five, but it's a different set of four. DNA uses cytosine, thymine, adenine, and guanine, CTA and G. And RNA uses cytosine, uracil, adenine, and guanine, uses uracil instead of thymine. That is why there are different kinds of nucleotides. Just like there are different kinds of amino acids only because of the different R groups, there are different nucleotides only because of the different nitrogenous bases. The sugar and the phosphate are going to be the same within that whole polynucleotide. All right? So it's very similar. You can think of either the polypeptide or a polynucleotide as building a string of beads. It can be any length, and you can use any bead possible at any position. The big difference is that the beads you're using for a polypeptide are amino acids, whereas the beads in a nucleic acid are nucleotides. And there are 20 different kinds of beads you can use for a polypeptide, whereas there are 4 different kinds of beads you can use for a nucleic acid. Still, they're both, though, unbranching linear sequences of monomers. Since there are different kinds of nucleotides, though, that particular sequence carries information. Just like a sequence of letters in language carries information, right? We don't have language with just one letter, because the only way we could have words would be to have different lengths of that, right? 5 L's, 3 L's, 16 L's, if all you had to work with was L's, right? Instead, we have different letters. Similarly, we have different nucleotides, and they can be put together any way you want. I mean, the order, the sequence can be anything you want. Well, that sequence is the information. Nucleic acids are informational molecules. The DNA sequence gives information about how to build an RNA molecule. The RNA sequence gives information for how to build the polypeptide. All right. More about that later. We're going to spend actually the whole second half of the term on DNA in one way or another. Let's look at slide 30, though, which is a DNA molecule. Still not a complete one. It's just a little bit of it. But this shows you that a DNA is really two polynucleotides in one. So it's a double-stranded nucleic acid. And each... That's why there are two ribbons here. Each one is its own polynucleotide sugar phosphate backbone. And then hanging off of the ribbon are the nitrogenous bases, just like the R groups of a polypeptide just hang off the edge. They're not involved in holding it together. But the arrangement of the DNA is a double helix, because each individual strand is a helix like this model. Helix is a corkscrew shape. So you have one helix and then the other helix right next to it. If you untwisted this, it would look like a ladder, right, with rungs. But then if you twist that ladder, it would turn into this. So it's a double helix. And the sugar phosphate backbones of each strand hold the strand together. But then the nitrogenous bases that are sticking off interact with the nitrogenous bases of the other strand in that same position, forming hydrogen bonds, which is what the ellipses here, or the three dots, mean. Okay, so that's what holds the two strands together, hydrogen bonding, to form the overall DNA. And so let's just remind ourselves of what I told you the two major jobs of DNA are. What are those two major functions? Not directly. Well, what is the indirect job that DNA performs with the ultimate goal of building a protein? What is the part that DNA is directly involved in?
Making the instructions for the RNA.
Transcription. That's the part that it's directly involved in. And the information in DNA gets used to build an RNA that's now going to carry the information. That is transcription. That's what DNA is directly involved in. So that's one of its major functions. What's the other? No, the transcription is the first part of building a protein. because you have to have the messenger RNA as a set of instructions for how to build the protein. A cell doesn't know how to make RNA either. It has to be told by the DNA how to make the RNA. What did you say?
Translation
is does not involve DNA. That's RNA and ribosomes that do the translation. And that's what actually assembles the polypeptide. But by then, DNA's job is done. Transcription is all it's directly involved in as far as protein synthesis is concerned. There's another major job, though, that DNA performs, and that is replication. Because of this double helical shape, and, well, not really the shape, but because of the fact that these two strands that make up a DNA are complementary to each other, there's complementarity, which is kind of like an inverse. That means that whatever the sequence of nucleotides is, CCs, A's, and G's on one strand, the other strand has a complementary sequence. So if there's an A, an adenine, at one position on one strand, the same position on the other strand has to be a thymine, a T. It's always A with T, it's always C with G. All right? And for reasons I'll get into later, that allows DNA to have the remarkable property of being able to form an exact copy of itself. And that's what replication refers to. Now, without this, we wouldn't have cells creating new cells. Right? Which cell theory says that cells come from pre-existing cells. Well, when that happens, one cell splits into two, right? If those both of those cells that came from the one cell are going to live, each of them needs not only DNA, but all of the DNA that the original cell had. So the only hope you have of having both of those two cells survive is if you first, before splitting, make an exact copy of all your DNA so you have two sets, and you give each cell a full set. That's what replication is for. It allows for cells to be created out of pre-existing cells. And 31 is the last slide on the show, but I'm not going to read this to you because I've gone through all this. This is a summary slide, but I include it in here because these summary slides are sometimes useful to study with. So that is that chapter.